make this day go on forever. These revelations got me seeing life like I have never. So sublime, so just unwind and take this trip with me. There's something in the water, here lay front cruising on LSD.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked and the host of this podcast. And today we're talking about huge opportunities to do something amazing and great with a movie or a TV show or a piece of music or a joke. We talk about a funny thing Will Ferrell almost did on a job interview that would have been amazing. Instead of doing the thing that seems obvious and exploding with potential, they do something mediocre and the potential evaporates. Not the Will Ferrell thing. I mean, he just didn't do an amazing thing and still went on being a hilarious person. But with a movie, once something comes out and is mediocre to shitty, media critics will write about it like its mediocrity was predetermined. You thought Walking Dead was going to be good? Snarf. By the way, I think hipsters should adopt Snarf as their new meh. Get on it, hipsters. But yeah, when a good idea is squandered, the fact that it was ever a good idea in the first place gets erased from history. Like Marty McFly watching his brother and sister get erased from childhood family photos. Like they never existed in the first place. And his parents had just taken a mostly empty photograph of their only child standing alone. Back to the Future. It's not as scientifically plausible as I thought it was when I was a kid. But anyways, I Am Legend, for instance, comes out and it's a work of middling bullshit. And every article that is ever written about that movie from that point forward puts it in that context. Any potential gets retroactively deleted and we just think of it as being one big ball of a shitty thing. But the truth is that I Am Legend was almost amazing. It had a hardcore existential mindfuck of an ending. Will Smith was supposed to realize that the vampires he's been trapping and killing and testing are sort of an advanced benevolent species that have evolved to replace us, and he is the legendary monster that they will tell their kids about. That's why it's called I Am Legend. The only way it could have been clearer is if they called it, oh, so I'm the asshole. But they shot that ending. The vampires break in and tell him he's a jerk, and they were just trying to save their fellow vampire he has trapped in his bunker that he's been testing on. But that didn't test well, so at the last minute, they just made him into a heroic martyr, and the monsters that were secretly an advanced race became monsters that were monsters. And from that point forward, I Am Legend is just Snarf, and it's always been Snarf, and always will be Snarf. I hope this is sinking in. So that's what we're talking about. Great ideas and amazing possibilities hiding behind some of our most mediocre culture that someone had to come in and sort of surgically remove or at least decide wasn't worth the effort. Because when you pretend that didn't happen and pretend that just shitty things were always shitty, you create sort of this false reality that is less interesting and less hopeful and more cynical than the way the world actually is. So we'll start out with Walking Dead, move on to every superhero franchise's third chapter. I'll talk about movie sequels from Jaws 2 up through The Avengers, which seems to have figured it out. Soren talks True Blood, Dan talks a super band that could have been amazing and wasn't. I talk The Grey Album, the Jay-Z Beatles mashup by brilliant producer Danger Mouse, and what could have been instead of the Jay-Z Linkin Park collaboration that followed it. Then we move on to Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, that Aaron Sorkin project about SNL. And then a great thing Will Ferrell almost did in his first interview with Lorne Michaels. And then I'll be back at the end for a quick anecdote and some footnotes. I am speaking with Daniel O'Brien in studio. I'm not going to give a big introduction. These people know who you are. And Soren Bowie.
It's your boy.
Oh, God. And today we are talking about squandered premises, as Soren told me that I had to pronounce it instead of premises, throughout pop culture history. Just these turning points where things could have gone one really awesome way and instead went in a less than awesome way. And Dan, this is a topic that you wanted to talk about, so Why don't you get us started?
It's born out of I pay so much attention to entertainment and pop culture news that I get pre-excited over almost anything that's going to happen. As soon as I find out, oh, they're going to make a Steve Jobs movie and David Fincher's going to direct it and Aaron Sorkin's going to write it and Christian Bale's going to play Steve Jobs, I get very excited about that kind of thing and will spend months hyping myself up.
Just
only
doing
to find
push-ups.
Out that, like, Fincher drops out, Christian Bale was never asked about it, and Aaron Sorkin is Aaron Sorkin about things. So I get hyped for a lot of these projects, and either they don't come to fruition or they just ultimately let me down. I've talked about Walking Dead so much on the site, and people are now mad about it, so I won't go into a lengthy thing of why Walking Dead is the biggest wasted potential of anything that's ever happened in the history of time.
Is there, like, one kind of key change that you would have made to Walking Dead, just so these people know that you're the squandered premise master?
Right. What they could have done with that show is tell us what happens to people when the world breaks down. After the world ends, what does that do to society? Make it more Lord of the Flies, where this is what man is at his core. And instead, they're still following around a sheriff, which is a completely arbitrary decision. And we're not showing what happens next to society. We're just a bunch of sad people. And the dialogue is almost to a word, either, man, things used to be better before the zombies came, or, man, things are so bad now that there are zombies. And that's it. It's just a hopeless show where people sit in a place not long enough for, like, roots to take hold and for people to establish a new sort of order. They just sit there until the end of the season when the zombies or some other guy runs them out of town. I want zombies in the background, honestly. I think once you fight zombies for a while, you should learn enough tricks that you can keep them at bay for the most part. They shouldn't be the primary antagonist. They should just be sort of the bumpers that are around wrecking shit up and entering some kind of chaos into the world. Mostly, I want to know who seizes power when the world ends. Who are the opportunistic people? How do they rally? What is a real, true, honest-to-goodness post-apocalyptic show look like?
Yeah.
They could have done that, and they're just not.
The thing that you can do in a TV show that you can't do in movies is have that happen in stages, you know, like almost the way that Breaking Bad followed Walter White as he devolved into these stages. You could have each season be sort of a new stage where, oh, these people surprisingly have power now, and then
right.
this thing happened, and now it's the Stanford Prison Experiment, and then this thing happened.
Right. It was sort of like what Lost was doing very early on that I thought was super neat that they let get away. It's these people who land on an island, and the smartest, the most clever guy to me was Sawyer, who immediately from day one hoarded everything, hoarded every kind of medication, all the clothes, all the stuff that he found in everyone's bag, and just set up shop there, and was the guy who was in charge of everyone's stuff. And if you wanted something, if you were like, hey, I really need birth control pills, I really need Advil, I really need glasses so I could see,
he was like, you're gonna, like, have to suck all
right,
my dick.
What yeah. Now you need to tell me something. I need information from you. I need to trade some kind of thing. It's interesting to me to see this guy who is just in the normal world, he is a con man and sort of a drifter and a grifter and a thrifter. He can
maybe
be,
even a shifter.
Maybe a shifter. He can be a king in this world. He's one of the guys who, one of the only people who is smart enough to realize, hey, we don't need to just listen to the doctor. We don't need to listen to any kind of law anymore. Who's going to punish us?
Yeah, we don't have bedtime.
This is the thing now. You wish things were different? Too bad. I'm still the one with all the medicine, so
right.
deal with that.
The prison rules.
Yeah. Walking Dead had elements of that, I feel like. And there are glimpses at it, what it could have been. The time when they go to collect that old man, oh man, what's his name, from season two, who ended up losing his leg, Herschel. They went to go get him at that bar, and he was drunk, and then those two other guys showed up. You get to this point where you realize that in a small little society, everyone who joins your group is either going to be a suck on your resources, or you're going to be a suck on theirs. And so these two guys show up who are very sketchy and, like, interested in their women. And immediately Rick shoots both of them. And, like, that was very cool.
That was a neat moment,
these elements of what society would be. It's very much like The Road. You know, no one can be trusted.
A thing that Lost did really well and Mad Men does incredibly well is playing with each season being sort of a self-contained thing that you don't know where it's going to show up. And I feel like you could have a whole season that is The Road, and you don't really know what happened to make things like that and sort of skip through time a little bit. But it sounds like it's more just like a daytime soap opera in a world where zombies exist. Are the characters named after famous philosophers? Because that was helpful for me with Lost to know what each person represented. I don't know a philosopher named Rick.
Yeah, they're all named after dogs and Simpsons characters.
There's three Homers, two Barths. Sorry, I interrupted you and made you talk about Walking Dead despite opening up saying, I don't want to talk about Walking Dead.
I mean, I personally will always want to talk about Walking Dead because I have such strong feelings for it and I think it can be a great show. I've reached a point where I know our audience is sick of hearing me talk about it. And I know that I'm wrong now because people have said rightly, hey, stop watching the show that you hate. Why are you torturing yourself this way? And my response is, I just shake because the idea of stopping a show that I've already started is terrifying to me.
Yeah, but I think Soren spends most of his workday watching movie trailers, and you continue watching a show that you hate. But I think that's sort of what this episode is about, is I love hearing the premises of upcoming movies because then you get to imagine all the amazing things that could be done with it. And it sounds like you're not so jaded that you can't appreciate a cool scene in a bar where they just shoot two guys straight away even though they could have been innocent, because hey, that's a cool thing, you could have done so much more with that.
Right. I watch every episode sort of hoping it's going to be really great. I don't watch Walking Dead as Schadenfreude or to like get a stiffer hate boner. I watch it hoping that it's going to be really great and like with as open ears and eyes as I possibly can, and I'm just burned more often than I'm turgid.
Right. Burned right on the hate boner. It's got to be extremely uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's what you want in a hate boner, though. You want it to burn a little.
Yeah.
What was your other example that you did want to talk about before?
I could talk about third superhero movies in general or Dark Knight Rises specifically. Let's just talk about Dark Knight Rises because I thought Dark Knight telegraphed what Dark Knight Rises was going to be in a way that made me very excited for a superhero movie that I hadn't seen yet. Because Dark Knight ends with Harvey Two-Face dying and Bruce deciding, I'm going to take responsibility for all his crimes. Gordon, tell them it was me, the Batman, who did this. I've lived long enough to see myself become the villain. And I thought, that's great. That means that the third movie will not be sort of obfuscated with, here are the new villains that you need to learn about and pay attention to, and here are the new characters from the comics that we can try to introduce as quickly as we can and get you to familiarize yourself with. Now we have a story that I haven't seen before in film, which is Batman versus the police, which is really neat and interesting to me. And we've got footage from Dark Knight where you see him beating up a bunch of doctors and police officers. We know that he's doing it because the doctors are Joker's henchmen dressed in costumes, but that video shows up on YouTube and everyone's like, look at Batman beating the shit out of a warehouse full of doctors and police officers, and now here he is murdering Harvey Dent, the only cool guy that we had left, and two or three other people, however many other cops Batman took responsibility for the death of. That set it up so here he is trapped. You know, he's got to be trapped by the police. The police have to be after him, and he needs to fight them without killing them. You know, if they want a character for him to fight, make Joseph Gordon-Levitt or Tom Hardy the best detective in the world and a good guy. I'd rather see Batman struggle with this sort of, hey, I know you're a good guy and I'm a good guy, but I can't have you expose my secrets and I can't let you take me to jail, so I still have to fight you without killing you. That just seems like a more interesting premise, and it makes Batman the fugitive, which is neat. It makes him on the run and him public enemy number one, which is a fresher Batman premise to me than what they did, which is another version of the Joker, frankly.
It right. More terrorism.
Now there's someone who brings even more chaos, and his explosions are much bigger than the Joker's. So if you like the Joker, this one's louder and bigger, but more of the same, ultimately.
You thought it would suck if the ferry was exploded. Well, what if the bridges?
Yeah, and this football stadium.
So you wanted, literally beat for beat, Batman standing over a huge dam being like, I didn't kill Harvey Dent, and Tommy Lee Jones behind him with a gun.
I don't care.
I don't care.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted. And I wouldn't have wanted that if I didn't feel like Dark Knight set that up. Dark Knight ends with this idea that, like, we have to destroy the bat signal. He's lived long enough to see himself become a villain. All right, now the next movie starts. That was it. He stopped being Batman after that, and Bruce Wayne went into hiding. And now you have to learn all about this clean energy thing that he made that turned out to be a giant bomb.
Yeah.
And you have to bring back the League of Shadows because you want to, for some reason, tie it into Ra's al Ghul. I just thought, oh, what was the point of ending the second movie with Batman as the villain if 90 minutes into the third movie, everyone's going to say, we need Batman. Where's Batman? He's the only one who could save us. That guy who murdered all those cops. We need him to come back right now.
And also, it seemed like the movies were getting simpler. Batman Begins was this huge, big thing where, you know, you were flying all over the place.
You
then
start in China. He's a prisoner in China.
Batman doesn't actually begin until, like, the 50-minute mark of that movie. That's when we see Batman as Batman.
Right. And then Dark Knight, you get narrower and narrower down into Gotham. And then, like, if the third movie had used Gotham as a prison. He needs to stay there because he has to solve some caper while he's being hunted. That would have been amazing.
Right, which is another great thing about Batman that they left out of these movies. There was elements of it in, I think, the second one, that Batman, apart from being very rich and very smart and very fit and good at martial arts, he is the world's greatest detective. And there weren't enough bits and pieces of that in this, I don't think. And a third one, if you have him versus a detective, you've got Tom Hardy or Tommy Lee Jones, whatever Tom we can get, Tom Hanks, okay. Tom Green. Pitt, a
Tom
great...
Tom Lasorda, can we do him?
Yeah, I think we can. Pitt, a great detective against a great detective, and just these two guys trying to outsmart each other and stay a step ahead of each other. It's Holmes and Moriarty, and one of them is Batman. Isn't that neat? But they didn't do that.
Now, I want to take it a little broader than just The Dark Knight Rises, because I don't think anyone saw that movie anyway. So this seems to be a curse of comic book movies, as I think you alluded to earlier, that you can get two good comic book movies out of a franchise, and then things just seem to kind of go to shit.
Yeah, I think Marvel is starting to figure it out now, because they're doing a very smart thing. If you've seen Winter Soldier and Iron Man 3, and even Thor 2 to some degree, they're not doing superhero movies anymore. They're doing... Iron Man 3 was a buddy cop film written by Shane Black, and Iron Man happened to be in it, and some other robots. Winter Soldier was a spy thriller that had a couple of superpowered guys running around throughout it. And I think that's the smart way to do it, because what we've been doing so far is movie 1, origin story, movie 2, dealing with, can I really be Spider-Man? Should I throw out my costume? Now I'll put it back on, and that's the same as Dark Knight. Can I really still be Batman if my existence is creating guys like Joker? Maybe I shouldn't do it. Nah, I should totally do it. I should keep being Batman. And then 3 is just, we haven't figured it out yet. It's Dark Knight Rises, which is just more of the same, and it's Spider-Man 3, which is, he can't become Spider-Man again, and he can't get the same girl again, so let's just throw more villains at him. Let's make 3 villains this time, and let's make him get a different girl, and then realize, no, I want the first girl again. It's just a mess, that movie.
But you could watch the progression of it in the very first Batman franchise, where the very first Batman movie, where he's facing the Joker, is very, very cool. You're starting with him already as Batman, that's fine. But then as you go through those progressive Batmans, they don't know what to do other than give you more bad guys that you wanted to see. So there's like this very impulsive desire to see all these other bad guys that you know from the comics, but that's all they're satisfying. They're not giving you a story necessarily. They're just saying, okay, well, we had 2 bad guys last time. Let's see. Let's do 4.
It's amazing that of the 2 stars of the movie Twins, they started with Danny DeVito before they went to Schwarzenegger as a Batman villain in that franchise. I think my squandered premise sort of mirrors what you're talking about here. There was just a general sense that you didn't take movie sequels seriously. But there was this sort of addiction to always keeping the same protagonist. This notion of, what if you had a very similar movie set in the same universe with the same stakes, but you just moved it over to this guy who was very similar and told a similar story? I think that's why Iron Man 3 is able to still feel like it has life, because you're getting breathers from Iron Man. It's not just like a linear story of Iron Man doing this. You know, he's getting to play in this giant sandbox of the Avengers universe and all these different movies. And it just brings some freshness to that franchise, where you can do, oh, what if we just gave the Lethal Weapon guy the third movie and like just made a kick-ass Lethal Weapon Iron Man movie? For a long time, the only movies that had really tried a franchise that switched protagonists were the Fugitive franchise. Mm-hmm. We went from Dr. Richard Kimball to Wesley Snipes, and we kept Tommy Lee Jones.
Are you counting Demolition Man as part of Fugitive? what did Wesley Snipes play the Fugitive?
U.S. Marshals was...
That's a sequel to the Fugitive, apparently.
And then the Bourne franchise tried it more recently, and did you guys see The Legacy?
Yeah.
You didn't like it?
Did you hear my tone?
Yeah. No, I liked the first half of it. I thought it was cool. They like built out some cool detail in the Bourne universe. And it's happening concurrently as Matt Damon's out tearing shit up. And it was just like a really cool idea. And then they just ended as the same way U.S. Marshals ends. Yeah, he gets away, gets the girl, and everything's cool.
Right, he does
cool.
The same thing that they did in the Bourne movies. He just has to fight a bunch of bad guys and then sneak away with the girl, and they play the same music when they find out he survives, I think.
But so, Jaws is my favorite movie by far, and the second Jaws movie, I still like.
Is my second movie.
It's my second favorite movie. Nothing comes close. No, the second movie, you can see everybody in the movie sort of giving up on it as the movie goes along, because it's so ridiculous that the same thing is happening off the coast of the same island. He has to convince the same mayor. He's like, it's a shark attack. And the mayor's like, ah, you're crazy, Brody. And it's the same thing with the Die Hard movies. And we can talk about those in a second. But it was like you had to follow this central protagonist off a ledge into a canyon of insanity, to the point that the third movie, they couldn't get Roy Scheider. He was like, fuck you, are you kidding me? And so they make it about his son working at SeaWorld. They're just like, well, he's got the last name, like, that's better than nothing.
And the shark knows that. Well, the shark is like, are you of the same Brody clan? Oh man,
no, the fourth movie, I swear to God, the fourth movie does that. The fourth movie,
it's Jaws's mom, right? Versus Brody's wife? Is that?
No, yeah, it chases Brody's youngest son down. The little kid from the first one is now grown up and gets eaten in the opening scene by a shark off the coast of Amity Island. And then his wife is like, ah, man, maybe we should leave this island after all. So she goes down to the Bahamas, and the shark follows her down to the Bahamas.
That's amazing.
You don't need to, like, follow this one family throughout things. And I would say you definitely need John McClane for Die Hard, my second favorite movie. But it was weird that they felt like the stakes had to be exactly the same, that he accidentally happened to be there, rather than, like, make it Speed. Make Speed Die Hard 2.
Right. Make Die Hard 2 someone specifically seeking out John McClane to torture him, like they did in Die Hard 3, the second best Die Hard movie.
Right.
I mean, it's just studios being foolish. You'll see a movie like Die Hard with McTiernan and Shane Black and see how great it is and not realize that McTiernan and Black are the reason it's great. Man, this is a really good movie. Let's do a sequel. Let's bring in some other guys to just make a Die Hard movie now that we know what Die Hard movies looks and sound like. I think if you had kept the same creative team behind it, they would have at least come up with a logical next step, something that's not just paint by numbers, more of the same Die Harder.
But to be fair, I mean, in the 80s and the 90s, early 90s, we didn't really know how sequels worked yet. We thought that you had to have all the same elements that you loved from the first one, the first ingredients.
As a counter to that, I'm surprised that sequels are still so shitty when Terminator 2 and Aliens both happened.
Godfather 2.
We don't need to hit beat for beat everything that happened in the first one. Just extend it, broaden that world.
I do think that's sort of the general consensus, is that we were slow learners and we're just getting all the sequels wrong at first because it's hard to get them right. But I really do think that it's almost an arbitrary decision when you're deciding how to continue a movie franchise, that you would be like, well, we don't need it to be a good movie or have, you know, a really strong filmmaker. What we need is just Roy Scheider. We'll bend the rules of logic around just making sure that he comes back. That seems like at least a 50-50 coin toss when you're deciding what Jaws 2 should be.
Yeah.
You know, Jaws was the first summer blockbuster, according to people who say that. and that really does seem like a turning point. You're making up the rules as you go. And if they had just gone the Godfather 2 route and were like, you know, that first Jaws movie was really good. Spielberg doesn't want in, but what if we gave it to some other really great director? Yeah.
But that's such a big risk. I mean, I understand why they're doing what they're doing. There's no reason not to try and include as many of the same ingredients as you can, because if it fails, everyone's going to be like, why didn't you just do all the great things you did in the first one instead of trying to do something completely new and original?
Yeah, I mean, that's because why when Hangover 2 comes out, that trailer, they need to let you know, don't worry, it's the same guys and the exact same thing happens. Yeah. Because they would scare off so many of their dumbest fans if Hangover 2 was like, yeah, the only thing that remained consistent from Hangover 1 to Hangover 2 was these three guys. Now they have a completely different adventure. Here's another hour and a half that you could spend hanging out with these three funny guys who have good chemistry together. No, don't worry, everything's the same, but now it's in a different place and it's louder. Monkey instead of baby. Chang is back.
Yeah, but I think the Avengers franchise proves that you don't need to do that. You can skip around in the same universe, have different stars, have a TV show about the support staff, and each subsequent movie is going to be, like, more successful than the last. Whereas The Hangover 3 was, everyone was like, how did that fail? It's like, well, because the second one was, nobody trusts you anymore. Jaws 3 is a joke because Jaws 2 was a joke. And so, like, nobody went to see it. And Jaws 4 is hilarious. You should definitely watch that. Just that arbitrary initial distinction that you couldn't do what Avengers has figured out you can do, and instead that you had to have John McClane stuck in another vent saying, how's the same thing keep happening to the same guy? Like, just calling out the absurdity of your plot, and everyone would be like, yay! Drop down and get jiggle on, girl. Drop down and get jiggle on, girl. Ain't no one leaving me alone, girl. Our friends NatureBox are supporting today's episode. NatureBox is a brilliant company with a revolutionary and delicious idea. No, they are not delivering a huge box of mango trees to your door, but it is delivering nature in the form of tasty snacks directly to people with mouths. Every month, we're all avoiding high fructose corn syrup, hydrogenated oils, and artificial flavors or colors, right? So is NatureBox. Each snack faces strict quality standards and are approved by painfully strict nutritionists who know how to keep snacking fun, but smart. You can pick your favorites from things like sourdough cheddar pretzels, teriyaki twists, or go wild with a rotating surprise box each month. Snack better, snack smarter, and snack plentifully. Go to naturebox.com/cracked to get 50% off your first box. Go check out naturebox.com/cracked today. Back to the episode.
Yeah. The premise of the podcast is squandered premises.
It's okay, thank you.
And now it's your turn.
I'm caught up. If you're listening at home or, you know, by fireside, you should know that Jack and I are sharing a microphone. So when we talk into it, we're just about kissing every single time.
If you've ever seen Bruce Springsteen perform, or no, it's Aerosmith, I guess. I always get those two.
Steven Tyler.
Yeah, they go back to back and put their mouths really close together. That's how we're doing this whole
thing. Also, Steven Tyler's mouth is so big that really it's never not close to somebody else's mouth. Ooh, ooh.
This is Daniel. I get my own microphone.
It's true.
It's just a talent and power thing.
It's actually about that hate boner you keep popping. It's kind of grossing everyone out.
So I want to talk about the show True Blood, which is a show that I think a lot of people already gave up on a long time ago. But
not this guy.
Well, I feel bad for you then. It's a show that if you watch the opening sequence, they have the song and all the credits come up. It looks like it's going to be the best show in the world. The tone is so perfect for the South, like the Deep South. This looming threat of vampires and maybe even some magic is very, very cool. And the show never, ever lives up to that. The first season is tolerable, but it's such a mishandled premise because you could do so much more with vampires in the Deep South. Deep South already has this mythos to it. The magical, this like dark magic. Serpent in the Rainbow. Have you guys ever seen that movie?
Ugh, no.
Well, they deal with voodoo a lot in that movie. Voodoo in a very real way. If Christopher Nolan was to make a movie about zombies, this would be it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Southern Gothic is like a whole genre of art and painting and literature that goes back hundreds of years.
Yeah, so you could have done a movie or a show that was about that, about the Deep South, about the magic of voodoo, and it's a very creepy but very real type of supernatural, and then you put vampires into that mix who are also trying to get by. And the main characters, who are clearly not suited for this world, just fleshy, pulpy humans, having to deal with the fact that they never really know if they're dealing with something that can be explained by science or is also just vampires killing everybody. Yeah. And you have characters who you don't know you can trust. You know, you'd have the quintessential blind guy who's got just pure white eyes. I don't want to get into specifics.
Yeah, this is you've got a fleshed out Bible for this show.
But it could have been really fantastic. And instead they did what I think a lot of what we've already been talking about with sequels, what they do is that the writers of the show saw that you could be successful if you created a vampire story that also had these other supernatural elements. And so they tried to throw in as many as they could. They put in werewolves and shapeshifters and fairies and
witches
and dwarves, maybe? I don't know.
Not yet.
Okay.
I mean, no spoilers if you know about the next season.
And then they fell in love with their original characters. So they started refusing to kill people off, but continue to add new characters. So now it's just this huge bus of people who you can't possibly follow all of their stories. And no, you don't really want to anymore, because the supernatural element of it, because it's not grounded in that real kind of something that actually exists in the world like voodoo, you don't care about anything anymore. The magic doesn't matter.
That's a good articulation of another general misstep in television fiction right now, is following too many characters. I think Game of Thrones is a neat thing where we haven't seen Littlefinger for a season. They could have, like, oh, we still have this guy, we still have Mayor Carchetti on contract, so let's just go see what life is like for him on a boat and maybe some side adventures. But they didn't do that because he's not the most interesting thing going on right now, and they just don't have any use for him. True Blood refuses to put anyone to the side because they know, last season was a good example, Alcide, the Joe Manganiello, the big werewolf guy, he didn't fit into the central story of what that season was about. They had no use for him, but they knew they wanted him eventually at the end, so they just devoted time every single week to this side soap opera with him, where it's like, all right, he's got to hang out with these other werewolves from a different pack and get into fights and meet a bunch of people, only to, at the end of it, ultimately decide, you know what, I don't really like this, I don't like hanging out with you guys, and it looks like Sookie's done with her adventure, so I'm going to go back there now. I didn't need to see any of that. We didn't need to waste any of time with these characters, and so many shows do that, where they just know, well, we've still got this person under contract, so let's just check in with them. Let's say, oh, he's started a bakery.
And you don't, yeah, they just don't have any faith. You don't have to do that. You can leave a character out for long periods of time, and nobody cares. I mean, yeah, there's so much going on in the story already that you don't need to follow Theon Greyjoy being tortured for an entire season by somebody who you never even find out his name until the very end.
Yeah, that was the one example of Game of Thrones doing that, checking back in with a character that wasn't doing anything interesting repeatedly. And it was striking because it sort of reminded you, this is what every other TV show does, and this is the only time that Game of Thrones has ever done that. The most recent episode ended in the purple wedding, and we won't say what happens at that wedding for fear of your wrath, the internet, but it's a 30-minute scene, an insanely long scene, because it earns it with dramatic weight and importance to sort of the overall narrative. So they don't go from there to B story arc, C story arc.
Right, thank God they didn't wisely check in with, man, this wedding is really important, but I wonder what Samwell Tarly is thinking about all this right over on the wall.
Right.
The Theon thing is interesting just as a tangent about the books. It's handled so much better in the books because the torture was an invention of the show because they still had Alfie Allen on contract, or I don't know why they did it. But in the books, Theon is gone at one point. Like, he gets bonked on the head at Winterfell, and then we don't see him for a book. Every chapter is from inside the head of a different character. You get Jon Snow chapters and Stannis chapters and Onion Knight chapters. And there's one that just starts with someone named Reek. And you go through this whole chapter of this guy, like just some tortured, mutilated guy who is mumbling and crazy, who serves Ramsay Snow, Ramsay Bolton, and just this pathetic puppet creature that's like, my name is Reek, rhymes with leak, never speak, womp womp womp. And he's eating rats and he just has this horrible life. And then you find out at the end of that chapter, his name used to be Theon Greyjoy. And you're like, oh shit. And that's so much more powerful
awesome
than watching him get tortured.
How are they going to get those two visual puns in where they talk about his dick being cut off and then show a sausage? Someone eating a sausage, though, Dan.
Book three, if you flip through the pages, there's an animation of George R. R. Martin doing that in like the corner.
It's they did
like
that a flip twice. Book thing.
Yeah.
Just to really make sure you know that he's been castrated.
Did you want to talk about missed opportunities in music, Jack? Because I was thinking of one of those.
Let me hear yours, and then I can get into mine.
There was a supergroup being built. It was called Them Crooked Vultures, and it was John Paul Jones, obviously, Dave Grohl from Nirvana and Foo Fighters, and Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age.
When was this?
A couple years ago, maybe. 3 or 4 years ago. And I was so excited when I found out that those guys were going to do something together, because what a great combination. Josh Homme, I think, is a neat songwriter and a fantastic guitarist. And the misstep was that he was their lead singer. He sang all of their songs. And so every single song just sounds like a Queens of the Stone Age song, because he has such a very specific voice that he can't not sound like Queens of the Stone Age. And he's just not as good as Dave Grohl at singing, I don't think. And I know that Grohl was playing drums, but if you're going to have something that sounds like the best Queens of the Stone Age album you've ever heard, because John Paul Jones and Dave Grohl are better musicians than whoever Homme has backing up, if that's what you're going to end up with, don't call it a supergroup, don't call it a different name. Or if you want a supergroup, get in a singer that's going to add some new dimension, a new flavor to that.
Or use multiple singers.
Yes.
From within the same universe.
Right.
Just skip around to different... Did you know Dave Grohl, after Nirvana, did a brief turn as the drummer for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers?
TP and the HP? No, yeah. I didn't know that.
And
that's fantastic.
Was seriously considering just being their drummer for a while, wow. Which they wrote some really good songs.
Yeah, like, that yeah, but been you really think about cool. The drumming in those. There's nothing to that drumming. It's all 4/4.
Yeah,
it's all real simple and slow.
Fuck you guys with this 4/4 shit. That is true.
Wow, and that's the meanest I've ever heard.
No, it's Dan explained it in a podcast a few weeks ago. Just this sense of song structure that he and apparently everyone else has. If Soren has it, I don't hear math, man. I just hear the music, man, the spirit of
it. You sound very convincing.
Yeah. That's how I talk off mic constantly.
I hear the music.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about 2004, the Grey album comes out. I've talked about it once or twice on this podcast, and we've listened to it on past episodes, but it
That's the unlicensed mashup?
Yes,
yeah.
By Danger Mouse, who's a producer who was just starting out at that time, and he took the vocal track from the Black Album, Jay-Z's Black Album, and mashed it up with music that he sort of DJ'd together from the album that's officially called The Beatles, that's known as the White Album. And he sent it out as like an art project. He was still trying to prove himself, sent it around as a demo to people, and it just exploded on the internet. It became this huge runaway phenomenon, and he became famous for it. Everybody has it in their iTunes somewhere, even if you don't know it, even if you didn't download it, it's hiding there somewhere. It's really the greatest sort of mashup album, in my opinion, of hip-hop and sort of other music that I love. And my missed opportunity with that is sort of how Jay-Z reacted to it, because
he said, my word,
oh no, what is this now? He didn't comment on the Grey album for like 10 years or until 2010, so 6 years, at which point he was like, yeah, no, I thought it was really great work, good for that guy. But if he really believed that, it seems like he would have taken advantage of this, because he's a really smart businessman. And
Point of order, Jack. He's not a businessman. He's a business man.
So there's sort of the two sides of him. There's the artist who, you know, is just trying to create stuff. And then there's the businessman who is like, there's only so much good music out there and I need to like lock it all down. So his response to the Grey album was to make this horrendous album with Linkin Park. He just basically looked at the Billboard Top 100 of rock music right now and just picked whatever band happened to be like traveling through the number one spot at that point and was like, hey, them, why don't you do something with this Black album here and we'll perform it together. And it was a huge success, but it was not influential. It was just basically, you know, rap metal, just a thing that people had done before, really uninteresting. Why wouldn't he have gone to Danger Mouse, been like, that was really a great album. I am one of the most powerful people in the music industry. Let's work together. You give me your top 100 classic rock and alternative tracks that you would love to like mash up into a hip hop song. I'll give you my top 100 verses from my entire career. I'm fake retired at this point, yeah. So I won't lay down new verses. And we'll just make an amazing album together. I'll help license the music. Jay-Z's like good at licensing music. One of his most classic tracks is It's a Hard Knock Life with that Annie song chorus. The way he got that licensed was he went to the writer of the music from Annie and like made up this story about how when he was in middle school, he went and saw a production of Annie, went home and wrote an essay about it and like what it meant to him and the American dream. And like the guy was moved and gave him like the rights to Annie.
Jay-Z's just a good ball washer, that's all.
Yeah. No, he's just a brilliant businessman and like just really super charismatic. If he had used that power to like make a legitimate Girl Talk album with Danger Mouse before Girl Talk. But here's what happened instead. Jay-Z does the shitty Linkin Park album. Danger Mouse goes on to be the biggest, most successful producer of like indie rock and like rock music and pop music for the next decade.
Yeah.
And he doesn't make really hip hop albums anymore.
Was he Gnarls Barkley too?
Yeah, he made Gnarls Barkley. He's currently producing an album for U2. Ugh. He has been nominated for like 5 Grammys, which are the only thing that matters when you're judging musical qualities. No, but he makes really cool sounding rock music and pop music, which makes sense because the difficult thing about the Gray album was not getting Jay-Z's verses to fit. It was bending this amazing classic Beatles album around Jay-Z's already existing verses. So like he has this genius for taking the essence of really great rock and pop songs and bending them around hip hop. And he hasn't been using that at all for the past decade, but he's been like proving that, holy shit, he would be an amazing person to collaborate with on mashup albums, but it's just gone completely squandered. And there hasn't been another mashup album that's as high profile as this. If there had just been one really great, legitimate mashup album out front featuring 20 of the greatest rock songs of all time turned into the backing track for 20 of the greatest Jay-Z vocal tracks of all time, I think that would have profoundly changed the direction of hip hop and like made everything way cooler. I think Girl Talk probably still would have happened, and like The Hood Internet is another mashup DJ that I really love that we've played on the podcast before. I think those people are still great. I'm not saying we should have had this instead of them. It's just that those people might be household names or at least getting paid a little bit more in a universe where Jay-Z had been like, no, we're going to do this. This is like a legitimate thing, instead of being like, okay, what's the cheapest, shittiest version of this that I can cash in on? And that's it.
Because that Linkin Park Jay-Z album, I was actually surprised that he had anything to do with it, because it always played like the laziest thing in the world to me.
It's Frankenstein together. You have these kind of cool lyrics and a great beat, and then, well, now we're going to stop and let Linkin Park do a chorus for a little bit. It's like two songs that are just cut as roughly as possible together.
Yeah. Right. The thing that he wasn't taking into account, because nobody knew this at the time, is that Danger Mouse was like a genius producer, and like that's what made the Gray album great. This gets into sort of the mystery of why Jay-Z is so successful, because the way that most people found out about Kanye West was he produced the four most classic tracks on Jay-Z's most classic album, The Blueprint.
H to the Izzo?
H to the Izzo, Takeover.
And Heart of the City.
Heart of the City is a great one and never changed. Those are all like the songs that I had no idea Kanye West produced those four songs. Those are the four songs that are still in steady rotation on my Spotify from that album. They just like hold up perfectly. So anyways, Jay-Z knew good production enough to pull him from, he wasn't exactly obscure at that point, but he really defined the sound of this album. So it just seems like he should have known better than to be like, wow, well, we don't need this Danger Mouse guy. He should have been able to listen to that and be like, holy shit. This
apparently
is like,
just thought, yeah, the Beatles are great and I'm great, so that makes sense.
Right, exactly. And that was sort of what his response was 6 years later. He was like, yeah, it was a really good idea what that guy had, and he did it pretty well, and I feel honored to be on a track with the Beatles, but I think it's been done better since then, which, yeah, there are specific instances of people making better mashup songs, but that doesn't mean that that guy's not a genius and shouldn't have been making mashup albums with Jay-Z and just making Jay-Z even richer for the past decade.
Jack, have you heard the Beatles Wu-Tang mashup album?
Yeah, a user sent that to me, and I haven't dug into it yet, but
it's got like three or four really cool things on it.
Yeah, I get the feeling I'm going to really like it. And thank you to the user who forwarded that. Not to you, Dan. He forwarded it first.
Well,
fuck you, dude.
We used it on the podcast when I took over. We used the Beatles ODB crossover. We used Got Your Money.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that. Didn't care for it.
The nice thing about it is that even if that was mishandled by Jay-Z, it certainly didn't hurt the industry. I mean, that still persists. The figuring out how to match these songs up that are in just like the most ideal, perfect way that makes both songs even better because of it. I mean, that's still happening. There's a group called White Panda that does that.
There's tons of really talented people doing this constantly. They're not getting paid for it, and they're not getting as famous as I think they should be for it.
It's strange to me that Jay-Z wasn't sharper about this, because I know maybe with all his albums, certainly starting with American Gangster, he would release his album and also, here's the a cappella version and here's the version without lyrics if you guys want to just use this. I know you guys like mashing stuff up. Here, you can have
exactly.
it.
Exactly. He's really cool. I'm expecting a lot from him. I'm like pointing out the one thing he fucked up in the past like 15 years, but it's just conspicuous because it is a big fuck up that I think could have really like changed things for the better. And Soren, you're right that there's all this amazing music being made, but it's all being made underground. Nobody's making money off of it, which is sort of the case for the internet in general. Like, nobody's really, like, legitimized, you know, the internet as a distribution of any type of content. If you had Jay-Z using this symbol of online and digital art, the Gray Album, to sort of leapfrog into this next step that seems obvious to me now and probably wasn't obvious at the time. I mean, he might have just been super busy. If he had done that, I just think it could have changed people's mindsets. One of the classic albums of the past 10 years is Jay-Z working with a mashup producer, like a Girl Talk type, being like, we're making this and yeah. it's legal and that's a thing that can happen, and look how rich all you people are getting, all you record industry people and the people who originally recorded these songs, look how much richer I just made you by just you guys agreeing to be cool about it and agree that I went and saw an AC/DC performance when I was in middle school and went home and wrote an essay about it. And yeah. that's why you need to give me the rights to whatever AC/DC song Danger Mouse wants to use.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the internet being an example of this, of like nobody figuring out how to monetize that. Yeah, you could say that the internet is sort of the most mishandled the
biggest
thing.
Biggest squandered premise.
Yeah, biggest squandered premise in all of culture. As far as monetarily speaking, it is. I guess philanthropically speaking, it might be the best. But and we're a huge comedy website, and you and I are sharing a microphone right now, Jack. Let's get another microphone.
And pants. We trade on and off.
We should put a leg in.
I think there's a lot about the internet that benefits from this Old West sort of no rules, no holds barred thing. We wouldn't exist right now if everybody had figured out and locked in how the old media was going to make money off of the internet and provide content. It's allowed different people with different voices to kind of flower up in this less regulated market. I just think that nothing has gone well for the music industry yeah. since this time. And anything that you could do to legitimize a thing that the internet does really well could have only been a good thing. What else?
Other squandered premises. It's so much lower stakes. And something that you wrote about for the site, I think, back when only you and I read the site, when someone said, guess what? Aaron Sorkin's writing a new show. It's going to be about Saturday Night Live.
Oh,
Matthew Perry is coming, going to be on it. Hot off from Friends. Bradley Whitford from West Wing, who you just love. We got Amanda Peet on it. We've got, who's the old guy who was in the first episode? Judd Hirsch?
Yeah.
Obviously, the Aaron Sorkin show is going to work. Look at all of these people that you have attached to it. How can you get all of those people in a room and it be bad?
And
then it was. I still kind of liked it.
Yeah. Right. The really crazy thing is that it was as good as I expected it to be right up until they showed the first clip of the show that they were yeah. all... The whole thing was this high-stakes, behind-the-scenes story where they're making an SNL-like show and they want to make these really dangerous, controversial jokes,
yeah.
but like the network suits don't want them to.
Matt and Danny were brought in to shake things up.
Right.
With Pimp My Trike.
Right. In case you don't know, Sorkin made A Few Good Men and West Wing and Social Network, among many other things. And all of his stuff is sort of defined by people being in crazy high-stakes situations and knowing how high the stakes are. So this was about SNL, and everybody was freaking out because they're under deadline and this is national TV and they're putting ideas out there. SNL defines the zeitgeist and has for 20 years. And so it felt earned. And then I think at the end of the second episode, maybe the end of the first, they showed this opening monologue musical set piece that they had been fighting to keep in the show for their first show. And it was just like nonsense. It was like, oh, well, those aren't jokes. You didn't hire comedy writers to do this?
I mean, 30 Rock very smartly made their sketches jokes. That was the point of that show, was that all their things are like aggressively, cartoonishly dumb. And everyone working on the show knows it, which is why they can get away with, here's a cutaway to our sketch, it's Fart Doctor, and we made 900 of them. Studio 60 never made that joke. They did it all as like, look, I don't care if the president of the network, Steven Weber, who's also great, I don't care, and Ed Asner, fuck, what a great yeah. pedigree. I don't care if they come in here themselves and they say, you're not putting this sketch on the air. It has to go because it's important. This is about America right now.
Right.
We're going to do it.
I think that was
and then it's such bad jokeless comedy sketches, skeletons of very dated comedy ideas.
Yeah, the show starts with Judd Hirsch as Lorne Michaels, essentially, breaking into the live broadcast and giving this sort of, if you've ever seen the movie Network, sort of a, we're being like bought and sold and everything is bullshit, sort of meltdown, but also speech that makes sense. And then he's fired. He's gone. And the network brings in, it would essentially be the equivalent of like bringing in...
Well, Matt and Danny were former writer-directors on the show that got fired and then brought back when Judd Hirsch...
Right. It would be like if they brought Norm MacDonald in to take over SNL after Lorne Michaels had a breakdown. It was just like such a cool premise for people who really loved SNL. But I don't know that it was squandered because I don't know that it was possible for any comedy show to live up to the stakes that a Sorkin movie or TV show demands.
Right. I mean, Sorkin, his writing will never find a better home than The West Wing, where the stakes are legitimately high all the time, and everyone is supposed to be the smartest guy in the room, because Sorkin can't really shake those two things. The stakes are high, and everyone is smarter, and not even just like, oh, I went to school and got a good education, more knowledgeable about every aspect of the world. That only makes sense in the White House, where you would hire the smartest people you could find.
And but Social Network, I thought it worked because there's like billions and billions of dollars. And like Justin Timberlake had that great speech about the creator of Victoria's Secret. He made it life or death, effectively.
Yeah. I think that worked there too. And I enjoyed Sports Night and I enjoyed bits and pieces of Studio 60. But the White House is the really most solid application of what Sorkin can't help but do.
He just needs to make a bunch of movies about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
And just, that's it.
Speaking of political shows, I would say that another mishandled premise is House of Cards that's going on right now, which is one that could have been, I mean, you can think of Aaron Sorkin writing House of Cards, how incredible that would have been.
Yeah.
But right now it's being written by somebody who wants to hold the audience's hand through every single aspect of government as though they've never heard of it before.
That is a rare show that I actually stopped watching because I no longer thought it was possible of goodness. And it wasn't fun to hate watch. Every episode of that show is written by a West Wing fan who's very dumb, who can't come up with the actual political machine stuff. Knows that there's something neat about Washington and that people have to walk around and shake hands and make deals and make compromises, but they're not as smart as Sorkin or as knowledgeable about DC, so it's just...
It's almost patronizing watching the political thriller aspect of this show. They have people who are like, they get a bill passed in a day and they're like, we did it, we governmented, and they throw their arms in the air.
Guess what, everyone? 9 new laws for everyone!
Yeah.
West Wing, when they wanted to get something done, there were so many compromises and weird deals that needed to be struck, because that's how writers work. It's like, I will help you get this done, but make sure you add this stipulation that helps my constituency, and then you're going to need to square it with this guy and that guy. And it's really clever, it's really interesting, it's how things actually work in government. And the writers of House of Cards aren't smart enough, or maybe they were, the audience isn't smart enough, because they're like really shady dealings. It's like, what if I use my hands to push him in front of a train, killing him? Then he'd not be around to stop me anymore.
Yeah,
that's why I'm the best.
Yeah. And then like when he doesn't show up to Congress, it's like, hey, see, he's not here, so now we can pass the bill. That's not how it works.
Just going back to SNL, the funniest thing that ever almost happened, in my opinion, I know about because I read too much behind the scenes bullshit about Saturday Night Live. There's this interview that happens after your audition, once they're thinking about hiring you, and it's this legendary interview where you go to Lorne Michaels' office and he's been known to make people wait 5 hours while he's just back there wheeling and dealing. Like, you wait there while Mick Jagger walks into his office, and then
I will never get tired of reading about Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
He's one of the most fascinating. There was no one with as big of a cult around himself that I know of in the world right now, apart from cult leaders.
L. Ron Hubbard.
But all those people who are like a cult around him are the funniest, smartest people in culture, and they're all just like, oh yeah, it's all earned. Yeah. He kind of levitates a little bit. It's really crazy. So if you listen to even an episode of Mark Maron's WTF podcast, you've probably heard about his interview with Lorne Michaels. He was on the short list for a season of SNL and didn't make it. And apparently his interview with Lorne went really badly. There's this crazy high pressure aura around this interview in Lorne's office. And so Will Ferrell told this story in some behind the scenes documentary about his interview. And he came to the interview with a briefcase filled with cash. And
Monopoly money, not real cash.
I think it was meant to look like real. Like, he had Monopoly money under real cash.
Okay.
And he took the time to like put a briefcase full of cash together. And his plan was just, he walks into Lauren's office, shushes Lorne before he can say anything, sets the briefcase down on his desk, opens it. He's like, Lauren, you and I both know what this is really about. Flips it so he can see the cash and just walks out of the office.
Because so many of those guys have heard like, oh, Adam Sandler got this job because he ran into the interview and humped Lauren's leg.
Right.
And that worked. So I got to do something weird. I've got to right. do something that'll help me stand out from the pack.
So anyways, he chickened out, I guess, once he got in the room.
Yeah, he brought the briefcase with him.
Yeah, he brought the briefcase and... Like, it would have been amazing if it just, like, fell open.
It's still funny that he is a sketch comedy writer, performer. I mean, now the joke is that he's a sketch comedy monkey who walked into this meeting with a briefcase.
Yeah. Right, yeah,
and
yeah,
walked
exactly.
out with that briefcase, never once opening it.
Yeah, I bring that up because that gambit for a first interview with a really powerful person is still unused. If people want to use it, you can go with a briefcase full of cash, tell them you know what the count is, and just walk out.
Not a squandered opportunity, but on this same... premise, former coworker Noelle Wells, when she got hired by Saturday Night Live, she got a phone call because she was out here in California, and she just picked up her phone. It was a number she didn't recognize, and she just heard a voice. I have Lauren Michaels on the phone for you. She says, okay, I'll take it. And Lauren says, I don't know if this is verbatim, but it's close. We really enjoyed your audition. Looks like you're going to have to find some place to live in New York. And then he hung up. And she was excited.
She didn't know what to do.
Right. Yeah. She's like, oh, where? Why? Are you sure? And then someone called back and like, so this is where the building is. This is where you can stay. This is when you need to be here.
Yeah. There's another story where he told someone they got it by asking how they felt about wigs. And that was it. That was their only indication. And they didn't know until, they had to go back to his office like a day later and be like, wait, did that mean that I'm on SNL now?
Yeah. Draft day.
All right. That was our conversation about our favorite squandered opportunities. Seems like there's sort of a consistent thread on the movie sequels and the TV show examples, at least, of uncreative people making up rules. Your show has to have A, B, and C story arcs that we're following. The audience won't follow your franchise unless your protagonist stays the same or is a relative of the guy from the last one, that are ultimately completely arbitrary and based on nothing, and yet we follow them for no reason. Footnotes. This week, we went hard on hip-hop mashups. We started out with LSD, which is a mashup of Aliotta Haynes Jeremiah's 1970s hit Lakeshore Drive and LSD by Prob Cause and Chance the Rapper, Chicago rap song from last year that played with the fact that their most famous street, Lakeshore Drive, has same initials as the Chicago rap world's new drug of choice. It was mashed up by the geniuses who go by the Hood Internet. I referenced them during our conversation a couple times, including him effortlessly doing his thing on this podcast as my version of a prayer that he ends up fulfilling his promise. I saw him at Coachella last weekend. He makes James Brown look sort of laid back on stage. He's got so much energy. We went in and out of the ad with a remix of Diplo and GTA's Boy Oh Boy by Twerk, T-W-R-K. See, I think if Jay-Z had taken advantage of the Grey Album and given these people cultural legitimacy, they wouldn't have to have such bullshit names that are misspelled, because that's how you find them via Google search. Anyways, Diplo and GTA turned Missy Elliott's Work It into sort of a fast-paced EDM track last year, and Twerk has kind of slowed it back down to take advantage of the rampant ass shakery that the original 90s Missy Elliott track made available to anyone with an ass to shake. And finally, bring it full cycle, we have Draft Day by Drake, which mashes up that thing off Lauryn Hill's The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, which he wrote out to a song off that album last week, and apparently is obliquely responding to a diss from Jay-Z, who recently called him Miss Drizzy on a mixtape, Burn. And Drake returns the favor by making fun of him for being married at the end, which we're going to ride out to. He gets distracted by a Hunger Games reference in his own lyrics and derails the song to stop everything and tell Jennifer Lawrence that she can get it, which I believe is a reference to his willingness to allow her to get his dick, if
I'm up on my street slang. Anyways, Drake wins because his song is better than Jay-Z's, and Jay-Z's verse is about how wealthy he is and how he can buy art. Seriously, that's what he makes fun of Drake for, not being able to buy art. And meanwhile, Drake's just taking advantage of a great sample in an illegal song that works because it feels like he's having fun and it's just dashed off and effortless. And when you're rapping over something that you think of as an investment, you don't get to lose your train of thought because you get distracted by how much you want to have sex with Jennifer Lawrence. All right, I hope you enjoyed this. Back next week with more podcast. And then you never notice they miss it. On some Hunger Games shit, I would die for my district. Jennifer Lawrence, you can really get it. Yeah, I mean for real, girl, you know I had to do it for you. You know I had to do it for you. You know I had to, oh wait, sidebar, left some beat at the end so that all of you fuck niggas could loop it and get your lies off. Caesar.